Welcome to the Denver Community Church Teaching Podcast. Whether you attend our 10 a.m. gathering on Sundays here in Denver, are just checking us out, or listen every week from far away, our hope is that by engaging with Scripture, together we can explore and participate in the life of Jesus so that we can be a healing presence in our world. As you listen to this teaching, allow it to begin a conversation between you and God, you and the Bible, and you and your community. If you have any questions about DCC or this teaching, you can email us at info@denverchurch.org. To get connected or find out more about what's going on in and around our community, you can visit our website at denverchurch.org or download our app by searching Denver Community Church in the App Store. And if you want to financially support the healing work we are doing as we invest in our community while setting aside 20% of every dollar given to support our partners locally and around the globe, you can text the words Denver Church to 77977. That's Denver Church to 77977. Know that spaces like ours can only exist through the radical generosity of those who call DCC home. Thank you for being here. Let's get to the teaching.
Good morning. It is good to be with you all this morning as we continue our journey through the book of Luke. This morning, we're picking up Luke in chapter 15, which is one of the most famous passages in the book of Luke, but probably in all of our scriptures. As I read these words, you can feel free to follow along. The page number up on the screen is going to correspond to the Bible under the seat in front of you or around you. Luke chapter 15, starting in verse 1, says this. Now, the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of angels of God over one sinner who repents. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to the fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went back to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing, so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I have been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him?" "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." Now, whether you've spent a lifetime in church, or maybe you've just added church to your weekly rhythm, maybe you're more church curious, or maybe this is the first time you've ever stepped into a sacred space like this one. Chances are you've heard this story before. We know this story. And we're familiar with it in a way that's deeper than being able to recount the details to a friend. We know this story because something in it is imprinted on us. There's something about the dignity of knowing that you can always go home that we long for in our human experience. There's something about knowing that you can always go back to where you came from, that you'll be embraced. This week, Richard Rohr reflected on this kind of nostalgia. He says, even if the reality with which we grew up with wasn't ideal, there's still something in us that longs to go back from where we came, that longs for this sort of return to the oneness we experienced only in the womb. For Rohr, he calls this a holy homesickness, this desire to go back from where we came. And Rohr says that this actually speaks to something much deeper than wanting to go back to our physical homes. There's something about this that calls us back to the oneness that we had with the divine from the very beginning, that imprinted on all of us is a desire to hear that we can always go home. We can always come back to the divine. So it makes sense that we know this story, that we hold this story as sacred. And I think about all the sermons I've heard about these parables, where God is seen as the shepherd who will come after us no matter how far we have wandered off. And that's true. God's absolutely like that shepherd. Or I think about all the ways that a preacher has gotten up and painted this picture of a father who has his arms not just wide open waiting for me to come to him, but who runs after me when he sees me a long ways off because he has compassion for me. No matter where I've been, no matter if I come back, like the details of the story tell me, with a less than repentant heart, the one that comes back not because I realize I've squandered everything in wild living, but that realizes that I'm hungry and I need to go home. Yes, if you need to hear it this morning, God is that kind of God. What's maybe been acknowledged less is that God is also like the woman in that story, the one who lost that coin that was precious to her. And she searches the house endlessly until she finds it. This is not a new idea. There's a painting called The Return of the Prodigal, painted by Rembrandt around the 1600s. And in this painting, which I think should come up on the screen, art critics and historians have pointed out that the hands of the father are a bit different. One of them is a little bit more muscular, a little bit bigger, a little bit more masculine. And the other one is a bit softer, a bit gentler. It's thought that Rembrandt was trying to represent the femininity of God and the masculinity in God. That this God is a God who is always earnestly seeking after us. And while I find this all very interesting, with a fresh reading of this story, this is not the part that surprises me the most. In fact, I don't think that this is the part of the story that would have surprised Jesus' first listeners. Because the truth is, this story of the prodigal son is actually the retelling of another story that they know very well from Genesis. This story of the prodigal son is a retelling of the story of Jacob and Esau. And you'll remember this story because the younger brother, Jacob, has quarreled with his brother over his father's birthright and blessing. And after Jacob tricks both his father and his older brother Esau out of this birthright and blessing, he skips town before his brother can beat the ever-living out of him. And then, when he, like the prodigal son in our story today, goes into the world and the world doesn't treat him all that well, he comes to himself and he realizes, I can go home. Now, in that earlier story, his father's already passed. So his brother Esau actually gives us this picture of a patriarch waiting to welcome home that which has been lost. And that language in Genesis is almost identical to the language that we have here in Luke. Esau runs to his brother, throws his arms around him, weeps, and kisses his brother because he's returned home. So this idea that ancient people weren't quite as ready to welcome the lost as we are is a little silly. Because if even Esau, who by the way was not thought of all that fondly, is opening his arms wide, is running towards his lost brother, surely a father who thought his son was as good as dead is going to welcome home his lost son. See, that's not the surprising part of the story. I think what the surprising part of the story is actually how Jesus starts these parables. Because Jesus starts by saying, imagine you had 100 sheep. See, he doesn't think of himself or God the Father as that shepherd, that woman, or that father welcoming home his son. He invites us to think of ourselves as that character. We are the ones opening our arms wide for that missing son. And actually, as I think about this, it's not all that surprising that we have thought of ourselves as the prodigal for so long. The truth is, we are part of what sociologists have referred to as a guilt and innocence culture. In guilt and innocence cultures, we are always asking what the wrong or right thing is to do. Our greatest concern is that we will do the wrong thing, and then we will face consequences for the thing we individually did wrong, either now or in the afterlife. So I think, as a society, it makes perfect sense that the character we are the most afraid of being in this story is the prodigal son. The son who faces the potential of starving to death because he has made some very poor choices. But for Jesus' audience, they were part of what sociologists call an honor and shame society. In an honor and shame society, I am not most concerned with punishment per se. What I'm most concerned about is being ostracized. So I'm not asking what have I done right or wrong. I'm asking what have people perceived that I have done right or wrong. And so I wonder if as they heard this story, they were not most concerned about being the prodigal son, but if they were most concerned with being the forgotten son. You know, the son that the father forgot to invite to the party. the one who's out in the field and he hears music and he comes in and he realizes his party's going on. I think their fear might have been being that son who's asking, what could I possibly have done wrong to not have been invited to the party? You see, when we read the story from this lens, we don't actually have three parables here. We have four. We have the parable of the sheep that runs away and the shepherd who goes after him. We have that parable of the coin, the one that the woman lost at home. Then we have the parable of the son who, like the sheep, ran away somewhere out there. And then we have the parable of the son who was forgotten, the one who was at home, the one that we lost like the coin right where we left him in the field. And while we have long seen ourselves as the prodigal son in this parable, sociologists tell us we are actually moving away from the guilt and innocence culture from which we came, and we are actually moving closer and closer to the kind of society that Jesus and his early listeners would have experienced, that honor-shame society. As each generation passes, we grow closer and closer to this kind of world. One study I saw said teenagers are 30% or 38% more prone towards the feeling of shame than those in their 60s. And that wasn't just because they're in that angsty phase. Each subsequent generation was more likely to experience feelings of shame than the one before them. And maybe that's not all that surprising to us, as we've seen the rise of things like social media. After all, why is it that I take 12 pictures, but I only post that one? You know the one. It's the one where I have mastered the skinny arm, where I have held the camera just so, at the perfect angle, and where the light has reflected off my complexion in such a way that it looks like it hasn't looked since infancy. That's the picture I post. Or what about just my posts in general, where I am carefully crafting them to make sure that when my friends read them, they will see how hilarious I am. They might even reshare them. Or what about responding on social media? Because sometimes I get on there, and when people are responding to posts in ways that I deem shameful, I think I'd better tell them. And I spend endless time crafting the perfect response so I can both shame this person who deserves to be shamed, and as the likes come rolling in, I can be reminded of my own honor because I am on the side of justice. Or what about cancel culture? We've seen the rise of this over decades. May I remind you of the Dixie Chicks, or Colin Kaepernick, or in 2023, did you know we actually canceled Pumpkin Spice? I'm a little upset about the last one. I'm going to be really honest. We have lived through the rise of this honor and shame culture, which has given way to our identity politics, which, by the way, don't usually ask the question what's right or wrong, but ask your group or my group. One of the other factors that may be a little bit less obvious to us, but that sociologists have pointed to, is the widening of the gap of our socioeconomic system, where there's not a lot of class mobility anymore. And this has driven people to think about those people who share in their same struggles every day. All of these factors, along with a complicated host of others, have driven us away from this guilt and innocence system from which we came and towards an honor and shame system that looks much more like the system that Jesus would have been familiar with. And so when I think about Jesus' invitation to his early audience to consider themselves the shepherd, the woman, the father who welcomes his son home, I wonder if there's an invitation for us too, to consider ourselves in that place, to think about all of the audiences that were before Jesus that day. Because the truth is, there was a message here for those Pharisees and those religious leaders, and there was a message here for those who considered themselves the prodigal, the sinner, the one on the outside. And as our own culture shifts, I wonder if we aren't most concerned about being the prodigal, but if we are most concerned about being that other son. You know, the one who actually, according to the details of the story, provided the fattened calf for the party but then wasn't invited? And see, when we think about the parables in this way, there's also a tension that is relieved. See, one of the greatest critiques of these parables is just that. The critique that God is like a shepherd. Does he really hold us so carelessly that he will leave 99 for one? Inevitably, another one's going to get lost, and then we're just going to start this endless cycle. Or what about the coin? If the coin was so precious, how did he lose it? In the words of my own mother, it didn't just get up and walk away. And what about that brother? A.J. Levine, a New Testament Jewish scholar, has built on this idea as she talks about not only was the father thought to maybe be careless from a Jewish perspective, but maybe he's even a little bit foolish. Levine says the Sirach, which is a second century book of wisdom for the Jews, advises when the days of your life reach their end, at that time of your death, distribute your property. Then the Talmud follows suit in suggesting that the one who writes a document bequeathing his property to his children in his lifetime, as he becomes financially dependent on them, is responsible for his own misfortune. Like the sheep owner who lost his sheep and the woman who lost her coin, the father is about to lose his son, and he is at least partially responsible for this situation. You see, as we think about all these characters, there certainly is an aspect of them that reflects the image of the divine. The shepherd who goes after the sheep, and the woman who searches earnestly for the coin, and the father who goes running to his son, I think that's the image of the divine in us. I think that there are so many times that we are willing to go after that prodigal son who is lost. But I think there's another aspect of this story, that part of us that's maybe not completely redeemed yet, that part of us that forgot to invite the older brother to the party in the first place. As I think about this, I can't help but think about it in my own context. Several years ago, I was at a conference where we were talking about how we might diversify church leadership. We had a long conversation talking about how we might have worked to get more women, more folks of color, more queer folks into leadership positions inside of churches. And about halfway through our conversation, one woman stood up and exasperated, she said, "All the old white guys in this room, sit down and shut up. You have led long enough." And I thought, how many times have I wanted to yell those words? As she yelled those words, I recognized a wound inside myself. I recognized that wound that I have from all those "you don't belongs" that I have heard before. I wanted to yell those words myself, but I didn't. And as I sat there wondering if I should have yelled those words myself, I watched as she treated this wound within her as if she was playing this game of hot potato. As if she just got it away from herself and into the hands of somebody else, that wound would be healed. But the truth is, we aren't playing a game of hot potato. That was an infectious sorrow from deep within her, and I knew it because I have it too. And as I looked around the room, I watched as all these men who, by the way, their life work had been making the church a more diverse place. All these men in this particular room had been the first ones to speak up and say, "You belong. You belong. You belong." And when we came into that room with them, we said, "You don't belong." I started to wonder if this was actually the kind of belonging I wanted. As I watched them sink deep into their seats, as I watched their heads drop and their shoulders fall forward with that feeling of shame that I knew so well, I wondered if this is what it looks like to belong. Most of all, I thought of Jesus, and I wondered if when he told me that I belonged, is that what he meant? As we prepare to come to the table together, I want to remind us all that here at DCC, we participate in what is called an open table. What this means is that everyone belongs. It means that the prodigal belongs. And it also means that the Pharisees, those religious leaders, the older brother who we forgot to invite to the party, belongs. I want us to take a minute and ask ourselves, who did we forget to invite to the party? Maybe for you it's the prodigal. Maybe you forgot to invite him to the party. But maybe, like me, you forgot to invite the older brother. We all belong. And when Jesus looks at us and looks at our wounds, whichever set of wounds we may have, he looks at our wounds and he says, "I'll take them." That's what we are reminded of every time we come to the table, when we partake in the body of Christ, when we partake in the wine or juice, which is representative of the blood. What we are reminded of is the kind of God whose stripes have healed us, who have said to all of us, "You belong, and I will heal you." So as you come, I have a couple reminders for you. All of our bread is gluten-free. The shorter cup is going to be juice. The taller one is going to be wine. As you come, take bread, dip it, and take it as you head back to your seats down the diagonal aisles. When you come, ask yourself what belonging looks like for you. And more importantly, ask yourself, what does belonging look like to Jesus, the carpenter who's always building a longer table for us all to have a seat?